Hello and welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on today's programme.
It was quite a, I suppose you could say, a shock to the system in the department to have people coming in as advisors, because that had not been the practice up to that time. And I think there was a bit of anxiety as to how that would work out.
In the week when the Minister for Education, Ruairi Quinn, announced the appointment of his special advisor, I speak to a man who was special advisor to three ministers for education in the 1980s and ask him what the job was like then. You can listen back to podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes by going to our website, which is insideed.com. You can contact the programme by email. Our address is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie, or follow us on Twitter at InsideEd. You can also contact us by texting comments or suggestions to 086 8962 665. That text number again is 086 8962 665. First this week, we go to news. Barry Hennessy, who usually brings us the news roundup, is away this week. And the main education story from the weekend is the announcement that Professor Patrick Prendergast was elected Provost of Trinity College on Saturday. A native of Wexford, Patrick Prendergast is Professor of Bioengineering and has been Vice Provost and Chief Academic Officer since 2008 in Trinity College. At the age of 44, he is the youngest Provost to be elected in over 2.5 centuries. Professor Prendergast will be the 44th Provost of the College and will begin his 10-year term when he takes over from the current Provost, Dr. John Hegarty, on August the 1st this year. The Minister for Education and Skills, Ruairi Quinn, welcomed the election of Professor Prendergast, noting that he takes on the role of Provost at a time of significant challenge for the university itself and for the wider higher education system in Ireland. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM in the Dublin area and on dublincityfm.ie throughout the world. Well, from one new appointment this week, we now go to another one. Minister for Education Ruairi Quinn announced the appointment this week of John Walsh as his special advisor. John Walsh is education editor with the Irish Independent as well as Irish correspondent for a range of international education publications. He is a former consultant to the OECD, where he was involved in preparing four publications relating to teacher professional development, student motivation, adult education, and new forms of school management. He's a graduate of both NUI Galway and UCC. His Master of Education thesis formed the basis of A New Partnership in Education, which was published by the Institute of Public Administration. Well, to mark the appointment of John Walsh to this role, we decided to look back at how the first special advisor to a Minister for Education, Dr. John Harris, found the job when he did it in the 1980s. Dr. John Harris was the first principal of New Park Comprehensive School, a position he occupied from 1972 to 1990. He subsequently served as principal of Sandford Park School for 6 years and Wesley College for 7 years. He served as special advisor to Ministers for Education John Boland, Gemma Hussey and Patrick Cooney. He was a founder member of the Society for Management in Ireland and the Irish Association for Curriculum Development. Currently, he is General Secretary of the Board of Education of the Methodist Church in Ireland. When I met up with John Harris during the week, I began by asking him what the work of a special education advisor to the Minister for Education and Skills involves.
It can involve all kinds of different things, but certainly one may want to decide on certain policy issues at any time. It may involve a major project, such as setting up a new body, as we did in the period of the 1980s when we established the Curriculum Examinations Board, which has now, of course, become the NCCA. But that would be one aspect that I was certainly involved in that. One will also be involved in issues that come in and that the minister may wish to get a view on before making a decision. And certainly we did a certain amount of driving around the country, say, when going to open schools or another similar trips, and would on the way maybe be going through various files and making decisions, or at least having discussions about what steps might be taken or what decisions were made.
So it's a bit like doing the preliminary groundwork for the minister.
Yes, in several respects that would be the case. Would having ongoing dialogue really about how things were going and what one wanted to achieve. Of course, that would depend on what kind of policy decisions would have been made even before the minister would have come in. What happened in my case, there had been a policy committee in Fine Gael prior to the election in 1981, and I had been chairman of the committee that drew up that policy. And that was the reason I think I was invited in by John Boland, actually, because he was the first minister I worked with. But of course, he was only there for 6 months because the government fell.
And what policy area was that committee concerned with drawing up policy on?
Well, a range of different issues. The main one would have been that curricular one, to establish the Curriculum Examinations Board. There had been a suggestion that we would set up policy boards in incorporating VECs, but looking after educational provision in certain local areas. And that had been there, and at what certain stage there was even a bill drafted to bring that into effect. But as things can change in education and ministers change and governments change, that never actually happened.
And prior to becoming a special advisor, what preparation did you have for that role?
Well, just, I suppose, having been in education, having been a teacher, having been a principal of New Park Comprehensive School, which in its day was seen as one of the innovator kind of schools. I mean, that was the brief given to comprehensive schools when they were first established.
And you were the first principal of that school?
Yes. So I'd had that experience, and also being interested generally and interested in the political side of educational policy making as well.
And what kind of challenges did you face as an advisor to the Minister for Education during the 1980s?
Well, when I first went in fact, there were two of us for the first period with John Boland. Only after that, when I came back with Gemma Hussey, I was the only one. But it was quite a shock to the system in the department to have people coming in as advisors, because that had not been the practice up to that time. And I think there was a bit of anxiety as to how that would work out. And I was conscious of that, and therefore I always considered it extremely important to consult carefully with the permanent civil service people, particularly at assistant secretary level, of the issue before we would perhaps discuss what policy initiatives were to be made. In fact, we also established a regular meeting of the senior civil servants together with a representative of one of the top inspectors, because they weren't always involved like that in decision-making directly with ministers. And that was a body that I think helped to have a kind of common policy drawn up, but it enabled me to have the advice from the civil servants. The one thing I was very anxious not to do is to try and come in as if I was the one who was going to tell everybody else what they should be doing. Instead, I was trying to ensure that we took all the advice we could get from the permanent members of the civil service when then advising the minister.
Because looking in from the outside, as I was a student teacher in those mid-80s time, and it seemed to have been a turbulent time in the department. I'm thinking of, you know, cutbacks in the number of teachers, strikes over pay, cutbacks in school transport. It seemed to have been a difficult time, at least looking in from the outside.
It was an extremely difficult time because of, it was the 1980s was one of the times when we had the first kind of recession and all the difficulties that we've been having more recently again, only rather worse. But that, of course, was a great major constraint on what one could achieve in policy terms, because you really had to decide on what were the key things you want to achieve. You then had to try and justify that to the government, and particularly to the Department of Finance if it involved their funding it. And they would come back with a statement saying, yes, that sounds like a good idea, you can do that, but what saving are you now going to make in order to pay for it? So that did give us a major constraint.
And how did you deal with, say, the difficulties, say, teacher protests and student-teacher protests and so on at the time?
You just keep a low profile and keep going as best you can. Obviously, it was a time when there were marches going on outside the Department of Education, which obviously is not the easiest situation to be living with. But you just have to cope with that as best you can.
And going back then to the minister and the extent to which the minister can influence the education system, in what ways can a minister influence the education system, do you believe?
Well, yes, I mean, ministers can vary greatly in how they approach their particular office. Some are very keen to actually initiate new policy measures. Others are perhaps take a wider view of their overall government role and are less interested in changing things in the particular area they are. And I saw that between different people over time who held the office of Minister for Education.
You were advisor to three different ministers, John Boland, Gemma Hussey and Patrick Cooney. What differences would you have found between the three of them in terms of how they saw their roles as minister and what they wanted to do?
Well, certainly both John Boland and Gemma Hussey were very keen to be innovators. And they worked fairly closely in trying to bring forward their policies. And then, of course, preparing speeches to give to Doyle, Shannon and so on, and also as you went around the country. And so I would have been involved in helping to work out what sort of lines should be taken to try and sell the message of what you wanted to promote. Pat Cooney, who was the last one I worked with, was probably less interested in that. He had a belief that if things were going well, don't rock the boat. I must say he was a very pleasant person to work with and supportive of my role, but less interested because he had many wider interests. He was one of those who had the wider interest of other issues which were before the government at that time.
And to what extent do you think John Boland and Gemma Hussey were successful in delivering on the innovation that they wanted to deliver?
Well, although we established, say, the Curriculum and Examinations Board, which is probably the top priority for both John Boland and Gemma Hussey. John Boland, of course, wasn't there long enough to put it in place, but Gemma Hussey was able to do that. They achieved it by promoting in every opportunity, whenever they were making speeches, if they were opening schools, they would talk about the kind of things they wanted to achieve. They also spoke in the Doyle and spoke in the Shannon about doing that. So as to what they achieved, well, the Curriculum and Examinations Board did not survive quite in the way in which we had envisaged it. The NCCA did take that on. Now, the difference there really was that we had envisaged a situation where the curriculum and examinations should be the responsibility of the same body. And the purpose of trying to think along those lines was to ensure that the people who would set examinations were the same people who were designing the curriculum, which they ultimately would examine. And that, we felt, would be a good thing. However, the idea of the people who were designing curriculum being involved in the examinations was the essential thing that was changed later when the NCCA came in, because it didn't have that extra dimension.
Even though it is called the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment.
Oh, well, yes, but that was in terms of policies on assessment rather than actually the mechanics of running the exam system.
So you would have envisaged then the State Examinations Committee being part of the curriculum board. Is that right?
Yes, that's why it was called Curriculum and Examinations Board. And I know that we went and visited certain other places. I went over to Scotland to look at the system they had there. And they were quite interested in that idea that you didn't have two separate bodies, one that ran an exam system and the other that actually designed the curriculum. So I still think that was something. It was unfortunate that the brief of the body was changed when it became the NCCA. Maybe that was going to be just too much for one body, but the idea was to make sure that the examination system was not dominating the curriculum.
And that's what would have been different, you think, if they had stayed together as one body?
Well, certainly that's what we hoped would have been different. We can't say it was ever achieved.
Okay, so the influence then of the minister seems to be more at the level of the system rather than changing practice in what happens in schools. Is that right?
Well, yes, you don't. Ministers don't come directly and say that. It is trying to establish, yes, a policy approach which the department would promote. And of course they did. I mean, because in later years, the inspectorate were much more highly involved in actually curriculum initiatives and the changing as well. And I think there was a general climate, and that was, it fitted in well with what we had initiated. I think it followed naturally upon what we had initiated.
So when a minister then goes about influencing policy, what kind of policy instruments does he or she have at their disposal?
Well, the advice of the civil service, obviously, the advice of the inspectorate. And they then, of course, have to convince their government colleagues to support this, particularly if it involves additional expenditure. And that, of course, was difficult, as I've said, at the time in the 1980s. So because there's all kinds of procedures you have to go through about presenting memoranda to government and so on, and having given other departments who might have an interest in what you were doing the chance to comment as well. So that there's a fair amount of red tape that you've got to go through before you can actually make policy changes.
And they're all internal. You also then have to deal with the external forces, such as the teacher unions, the parents' bodies, and so on.
That is indeed so. And I wouldn't have been directly involved in that aspect. I was more involved in the actual education policy programme.
From within the civil service and within the government, is that right?
Yes. What policy should be being pursued? How we could encourage development of curriculum in particular, setting up that board. And it still, of course, has been very valuable since. It is an advisory board to the government still, to all the governments that they serve under. So I think that it was good to have opened the system up so that you didn't just go on year after year not changing anything, which had been the case for a long time up till the 1960s. I mean, there was a report in 1962, I think, which looked at the educational system and more or less said everything's fine and doesn't need to be changed. However, it wasn't too many years later before things started changing with the introduction of things like the comprehensive schools, community schools and all of that. All of those would have been initiated at government level and obviously starting with the minister.
Now, you've already said that you were one of the first special advisers to a minister for education. And I wonder, is there anything that you achieved as advisor that you're still particularly proud of today?
Well, I'm proud of one thing, that one has established the fact that you can have such an idea that somebody will come in and try and encourage the development of new policy. Government, I mean, departments and even people in it will vary greatly in what they want to do. Some of them don't want to change too much. Some of them need a little bit of encouragement before they will go along with changing. But ultimately, of course, they have to fit in with the policy position that a new minister, say, coming in, will wish to take. So that the fact that that was established and the initial shock, I think, ultimately died down with regard to somebody coming in from outside like that. Because it was followed on afterwards, when I left, the next government brought in an advisor, and more or less it's happened, I think, ever since. So that was established following that time. Initially, it was Garrett Fitzgerald who had wanted that idea that people would come in, bringing in a certain level of expertise and fresh thinking into any department, and he encouraged that happening in that government in the 1980s, and the only difficulties were always the financial constraints that we all had to work under.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine from the civil servant's point of view how it's probably could be threatening, but also could be very valuable to have new thinking and new blood coming in with new ideas.
Yes, and I think, I do think that that became more accepted as the time went on over the 4.5 years, certainly I was involved there, and I think it's gone on since. It became a more natural thing to happen. But also I think that we were giving the inspectorate a greater role to play in actually influencing government policy rather than just leaving it to the administrative side of the civil service, which had often tended to be the case in previous times.
So when a minister then, such as Ruairí Quinn, a minister for education, goes about looking for a special advisor, what kind of qualities would they be looking for?
That would depend on what the sort of priorities they would have and what they wanted to achieve. Because if they had decided on that, then they'd be looking around for somebody who felt they would have that sort of expertise and insight to assist them in achieving that those goals.
OK, and I suppose Ruairí Quinn, certainly one of his areas is the whole area of patronage of schools. What kind of challenges do you think he's going to encounter in that process?
Well, obviously, it's to make fundamental change of that nature and then have sorting out what different kinds of patronage you'll have and what's appropriate to different situations won't be an easy task. But it is, I think, appropriate and timely that that issue needs to be addressed. And certainly with so many of the schools being Catholic schools and now recognising that there is a need to change that, well, we yet have to see what implications there are going to be for that. So I dare say he's indicated that's one of the areas he's going to be interested in. So, and I suppose therefore that influenced his choice of John Walsh to be his advisor.
And is that a task that you would relish if you were a special advisor, to take on that challenge of trying to reform patronage of schools?
It wouldn't have been one that I would have felt as competent to have been advising on or holding meetings or discussions about. I was more interested in the curriculum area, and that was the one that was really top of the agenda at the time I was there.
And if you were giving advice to John Walsh in his new role now as Special Advisor to the Minister for Education, what would you say to him?
Well, that's really very difficult to know as to what way one would want to see things develop. It's always going to be so difficult when money is so scarce and it looks like being so for a long time. And it's much harder to try and actually focus on things. But certainly that one is now, I think, very relevant. And the provision of new schools and the increased number of young people now coming up to second level and first level, and the demand for so many new schools to be provided at a time of such financial stringency. So those are going to be the nightmares, really, and yet essential, because you've got to be able to ensure that all the children of the nation are educated.
Do you think there's any significance in the fact that John Walsh, while obviously having great expertise in the system, at the same time he's a commentator rather than somebody who has been involved in the system as a teacher, which you would have been, and particularly as a principal teacher?
Well, he has always taken a very broad view of education. He's had a lot of experience of dealing with ministers and advisors, issues of all kinds, so I think he would certainly come with that. But he has done his own research studies in education, which I think equip him in a very broad sense to have an overview of the whole system, which should prove very valuable.
And how do you see the education landscape today as being different from the education landscape that you were looking over in the mid-80s?
It's probably much more open, but also people at the receiving end of education, and parents in particular, are, I think, increasingly demanding about what they hope for from the education system, so that there's a much more openness between all the partners. And the emphasis of the whole white paper and all of that that went with it and the education acts that followed was greater participation by the community at large in education as an important aspect of life in our country.
And you've mentioned there you have an interest in curriculum yourself, and I suppose one of the big curriculum news stories in the last few months was the disappointing results in PISA in terms of our literacy and numeracy. Where do you think we've gone wrong, and what could we do to put that right, do you think?
Well, I think the efforts that are being now made and the suggestions of where we need to explore new approaches are in the nature of the examination system, which I think is generally recognised. It's too dependent on rote learning and not sufficiently developing critical thinking. And that I know has been stated by Rory Quinn, and it has been stated by many other educationists, realised it's the system is just too linked to being able to reproduce knowledge that you have learned off on the examination day, which you can then forget again as very quickly afterwards. You want to be able to apply the knowledge you gain through the education system.
And that was Dr. John Harris, who was special advisor to three ministers for education in the 1980s. We spoke to him to mark the appointment this week of John Walsh to the same position with Rory Quinn. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email us on InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.